Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's a Sunday. It's 10 p.m. here in lovely Skopje, Macedonia. The weather is an absolute armpit. And I'm very glad to say that summer has come around, which you can say because I'm wearing the summer shirts. And as people can say, my beard came off in the wash. It's quite an unfortunate accident, but it had to happen eventually. And tonight, we have Carl Thorburn, who is our resident finance expert, but finance involves a lot of math, so we're going to probe his brain a little bit on probability and game theory. Carl, how are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Well, like I said, it's...
You're in the devil's armpit.
Yeah, I'm in the devil's armpit, and he is not a user of deodorant, I will say that. Or actually, he uses some organic crap, which doesn't work, but just makes the whole thing a lot stickier. Right. You know, he is the Prince of Darkness, you know, he's one of these people. I hear he also farts on elevators. Anyways, we are live on DLive, and we are live on Odyssey, and... boy, what a nice gaggle of people we have watching. And now we're going to get to that part where I'm going to solicit your donations, people. So as many of you, the regulars, will know, we take donations. We take donations on Entropy, and we take donations on Cash App. And you can see the banner flashing right beneath me here, the links to Entropy and to Cash App. Just type those into your browser, or full of you impatient young people, just click the links, which our heroic moderators will post in the chat. And thank you for that, heroic moderator persons. We depend on you. Without you, I would actually have to work, which I always try to avoid. I try to avoid work like the plague.
How long has Countercurrents been taking money on Cash App? Is that recent?
Well, it is, I guess, relatively recent. It's been at least 2-3 months, I think. Maybe more. I don't really think about these things.
That's a good thing. I'm going to talk to Greg about that, because that's interesting. Because, obviously slipping under the radar there. It's a great thing.
Yeah. Well, the thing about Cash App is, now the difference between Entropy and Cash App is, Cash App takes a smaller cut than Entropy. Mm. I believe 5%, whereas Entropy takes 15. However, if you donate through Entropy, you can pose questions. You can ask me questions. You can ask Carl questions. Now, you can ask Carl about how things are going in the market, and I'm sure he'll do his best to explain the recent perturbations to us if we have time after our discussions of mutually assured destruction. Well, maybe the weight change of the beard is throwing off a little bit. It is entirely possible. And of course, you can donate to us through DLive. You can give us lemons, ninja guineas, and ninjets, and diamonds, and ice creams, and all those wonderful DLive tokens. And you can donate through Odyssey. We take Odyssey tokens. Those are library tokens. They're a kind of cryptocurrency as well. And I think you can also, you can donate cash money through Odyssey, American dollars, European euros, even Canadian dollars. We take Canadian dollars. We do not discriminate against the Great White North. Indeed, we had February specifically as Canada Month on the Writer's Block. We love our Canadian friends. And already people have been pouring in with the donations. We have Slog with his perpetual 14 lemons. We have Norse Nature donating 2 ice creams. That's from yesterday. And we have Wegbereiter donating a diamond on DLive. And I'm so rusty in German, I have forgotten what Wegbereiter means. If someone in the chat could just...
What is it? Is it W-E-G...
Yeah, W-E-G,
Wegbereiter
is how it's pronounced, but I haven't spoken German. I haven't used spoken German in about 10 years, maybe 9. I read very little German on a day-to-day basis. I used to be fluent 10 years ago, and now I'm just completely paralyzed.
I took a few German courses in college, and I loved it, but I haven't revisited since. But I also took some Italian and Spanish, but I hate those romantic languages. I much prefer German. It's just German to me is just so much easier to learn and also to speak. But yeah, like Italian was hell for me. I think I got like a D in Italian.
Okay. This is the first, you're the first person I've ever met who said Italian is harder to learn than German.
I think maybe the reason for me it was harder was because, number one, the pronunciation, but then number two, it's like there were enough words in Italian that were kind of close to English that I would get them mixed up and I would forget how to spell it or how to say it. Whereas with German, the words were typically pretty different from English. And so that actually kind of helped me compartmentalize it in my mind.
Yeah. Well, the Romance languages tend to have what people call false cognates. Mm. Like it's the same type of word as in English, but it means something else. Like, for example, in English, preservative is something you put in the food to keep it from going bad, right? Yeah. But in French, right, a préservatif is a condom. So you have the situation of people, English people going to France and asking whether the food has condoms in it.
Well, I think in Spanish, I think the word for pregnant is like avocado or something.
No, it's embarazada.
Oh yeah, that's it. It was something. Yeah, it's like I just remember learning that and thinking like, yeah, that's way too similar to embarrassed.
Yeah. Oh, and I forgot. I almost forgot our friends at Alaska Chaga. I'm actually going to start drinking it chilled when the serious heat comes, but I'm still drinking it warm for the time being. And it is a wonderful beverage. It's what keeps me going. It's what allows me to keep speaking for 2 hours straight during these shows. And of course, it's got antioxidants. It could have electrolytes. I wouldn't know about it, but it is. It's definitely helpful for multiple organ systems. I know it keeps it makes sure I get a good night's sleep whenever I have Alaska Chaga. So, and of course, smells great, tastes great. It's very delicious. I'm gonna have to try it in chilled form soon, and.
You know, I've done the opposite. I've eaten some. Rich Hauck actually sent me in the mail some delicious German chocolates that they're called. I'm trying to remember the name of it. It's like he calls them Panzer chocolates, but that's not really the name of it. It's like it's some kind of German chocolate that's got coffee in it, and so it's like the next. It's like the one step down from chocolate with meth in it. But yeah, it's made me a little bit hyped up.
Yeah, I mean German confectionery is just next level. I think that
it's so good.
maybe it's Austrian because I love the Austrian style coffee house with just the opulence of candies and coffee available. I think it really speaks. Maybe it just really speaks to my middle European. Sensibilities, right? Because you know, I was born and raised in the Balkans, but to me, always it was thinking about Mitteleuropa, thinking about you know the old Habsburg Empire, thinking about Vienna and Budapest and all these places as the promised lands in a certain way. And you grow to realize that much of that culture is German, or at least downstream from German culture. Mm-hmm. I probably used to know the name of those candies before. Now I'm drawing a blank there, I guess. But yeah,
we like do a have. Cylindrical tin, and it's called like Choco Colada or something like that. And But yeah, it's sad. You were talking about like the cafes and the treats. It's like, you know, in America, everybody just knows Starbucks, and, you know, talking about preservatives, like you mentioned earlier, Starbucks food, any kind of food you get in Starbucks is going to be chock full of preservatives. It just is really not good at all. So it's strange what gets, you know, that's just the nature of American capitalism, I think, is that, you know, it, what gets really big and successful in America tends to be just like a low quality bastardization of, you know, European style things.
Well, I don't like the whole just lording over Americans, that the culture. I will say that Europeans are not much better when it comes to consuming mass produced crap. Like, people drink Coca-Cola in Europe. People do drink, you know, crap coffee and eat bad food. I mean, it happens to a lesser degree, but it happens because the states of Europe tend to intervene in the market. If you just left it up to the consumers, it's not that Europeans are more cultured. It's that European states are less allergic to intervention in the markets. And that's really the decisive factor there, right? It's Europeans are not as allergic to state intervention in the economy for the common good, which I think that we can agree that good nutrition is the public good, the common good. Everyone benefits from everyone else being healthy. And it's one of these things, maybe we can segue into this as a digression, essentially, that we talk about keeping healthy here in the dissident right. We talk about working out, but we should not discount the fact that we are individuals, and individuals are not always capable of resisting the pressures and seductions of the modern world, that you actually do need the help of your community to remain strong. You know, it's why we don't just say to people who want to revivify their spirituality to become Christian or follow a faith, you actually have to practice with other people. You have to practice this faith. Otherwise, you fold, because no one man is strong enough to take on the monster himself. And this is this is actually true about health and nutrition as well. No one man is. Eventually, you're going to have to purge these temptations from the markets, right? Today, I was able to resist the big bag of chips or the pizza, but who knows about tomorrow?
Yeah, it's very rare, I guess, that somebody, an individual, has the extreme degree of like self-control compared to you know, a group of people who are trying to accomplish something together. But yeah, so we want to get into mutually assured destruction. I think what started this was I made an offhand comment to you at one point. I don't remember if it was in a chat or if it was on another podcast. It might have been in chat. But I just, you know, I just said, like, there's something fishy about the idea of mutually assured destruction. Like, to me, it just seems like it's kind of a little bit of a superficial concept. Like, it's, you know, it's like, well, two sides have all these nukes, and if there's a direct conflict between them, then they will, one of them will shoot nukes at the other, and then the other will, of course, you know, have no option but to fire back. And so this assures destruction of both, and it also assures, in a roundabout way, that they will never have a direct confrontation. And so they'll always be fighting proxy wars. And in fact, I think actually, if I remember correctly, we were talking about this before Putin decided to invade Ukraine.
It's been a while. It makes me think that this was in a show we did together. I think the last show about NFTs, when NFTs were still big. I think you made an offhand comment that you don't fully believe the mainstream narrative on mutually assured destruction, And this actually intrigued me because, you know, the conventional wisdom is, you know, we throw a nuke at them, they throw a nuke at us, and this balance of terror keeps us safe from nuclear war, paradoxically, right? And this is what became so interesting to me. It's like, okay, this is so counterintuitive, but I know Carl, again, I think we discussed this before we went live. As you get older, you don't really have time to countenance ideas, so you start looking at the people who bring them. Like, this is very counterintuitive, but I know Carl, he's a smart cookie. He's bringing this idea to me. I'm intrigued.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, actually, it's funny because I didn't really, I didn't pick this idea up on my own. I didn't come up with this myself, but I think that I had heard it from somewhere years ago, and I forgot where I heard it. And at the time, I didn't think too deeply about it. But then it kind of came back to me because I was thinking about game theory and Nash equilibrium. And just for people who don't know about this stuff, I think we should, you know, well, we've already kind of explained what mutually assured destruction is, but the idea was popularized by military strategist Donald Brennan, who he coined the term mutually assured destruction in 1962. So it's relatively recent. But what was wild is when I was researching this, I found out that it's actually much older than that. Back in 1870. There was an English author named Wilkie Collins who wrote, he was writing about the Franco-Prussian War, and he said, quote, "I begin to believe in only one civilizing influence, the discovery one of these days of a destructive agent so terrible that war shall mean annihilation and men's fears will force them to keep the peace." And so way back in 1870, there was already somebody who's speculating about the possibility of mutually assured destruction and terrible weapons. And, you know, and of course, this isn't even, you know, I wouldn't even limit this to nuclear weapons, because more recently, I think that it's fair to say most people who are in the know are aware that COVID is not the result of random mutations and some animal somewhere. It came out of a lab, most likely. And so aside from nukes, I think that, you know, if you had a terrible enough virus, possibly something similar to smallpox or something like that, you could theoretically wipe out the bulk of humanity, and it would be it would really, to me, bio weapons are even more stupid than nuclear weapons, because it's like you don't get to decide where they land. They always get out, and so that to me is more scary than nukes in a way.
Yeah, well, this is basically this is why even the remotest possibility that, for example, there are speculations that China is developing bioweapons which will specifically target white people. Right? Mm-hmm. This is not something that, you know, Russia can do, right? Because for all of the claims that Russians are Mongols or whatever, no, Russians are actually a white nation. So if they developed such, they cannot develop a bioweapon which would target, for example, Germanic white people that wouldn't affect Russians. But because there is a significant genetic distance between East Asians and Europeans, it's actually completely conceivable that, you know, the Chinese could maybe come up with this. This is what is so terrifying about the idea of, like what Ray Johnson is calling them in the chat, race-specific bioweapons.
Yeah. Yeah, the Chinese, they know that their only real competition globally is Europeans. I think that, you know, the Chinese know that. I can say the J word on here.
This is DLive and Odyssey. No censorship. Yeah. Just try not to break the law.
Right, right. Yeah, they know that. They know about Jews. They you know, their academics are in no way hindered or prohibited from discussing Jewish power. And so that means that they understand that, you know, if they were ever in direct conflict with Jews, it would be pretty easy for the Chinese to take care of that, because there's just simply not enough Jews globally to really confront the Chinese. Now, whites are a totally different situation, because we have the numbers, we have the dispersion globally, like you know, territory, we've got that. So even in the event of like a major nuclear conflict, at the end of it, you know, it would eventually end, you would still have, at the very least, you know, 100 million whites remaining. So with a conflict with Jews, it wouldn't work out that way. And also, you know, the Chinese are, like I said, are capable of discriminating against Jews, which whites really aren't to the same degree, at least not currently. And so they can't really protect against that. But yeah, so it's an interesting way to think about it. But I think, when, you know, thinking long term, generally, like, you know, look at the history of China, the one white pill, I would say, I guess, is that the Chinese don't seem to be the type of people to be acquisitive of territory. They're not really, and don't get me wrong, they do want Taiwan, and, you know, they want some periphery territory for themselves, but they're not to the same degree that Europeans have been. And who knows, currently their population shrinking, you know, they have below replacement fertility rate, thank God. yeah. And I expect it, you know, to continue falling, because just that's sort of like the trade-off, I guess, when you're a superpower, is that you have a choice. You can either go the African route, which is where you continually grow your population. But the problem there is that you have low IQ, so you can't really feed yourself after a certain point. Or you can go the Jewish route, which is like the other extreme, which is where, you know, they have extremely low fertility, except among the hyper-religious, low IQ Jews. And but the trade-off is that they get to have advantage of the IQ.
I'm not sure that the hyper-religious Orthodox Jews are low IQ, although they are lower IQ than the, you know, yeah, libtard Jew. Well, not, I wouldn't call them low IQ, really.
I think that
maybe lower. Yeah, I don't, definitely.
I really don't know how they compare directly to Ashkenazi. I know that I remember reading somewhere that the average IQ in Israel is like, you know, 86 or something, really low like that. And I think that might be dragged down a little bit by Palestinians living there, and also by certain subgroups of that are not Ashkenazi. But the Orthodox Jews, I don't know.
They're the claim of a 105 average IQ for the Ashkenazim is very obviously overblown. I expect them to, basically, they should have an IQ comparable to, let's say, Eastern and Southern Europeans, because they are genetically mixed with Eastern Europeans and, yeah, and Northern Italians. So you would expect... And they have also Semitic admixture, Ashkenazi Jews, yeah, but because they were so endogamous for so long, we can isolate them genetically speaking.
I think what
benefits... So I would say in the ballpark between 95 and 100 average IQ for Ashkenazim, and I would expect Sephardic Jews to have IQs comparable to other Mediterranean nations, like so Southern Italians, Greeks, Arabs. So between 90 and 95, if Israel has lower than average IQ, I would say this is probably the Arabs, the Druze, and the Mizrahim Jews dragging it, yeah, down. These are the Arab Jews, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. And people are saying in the chat that the Orthodox, like the Hasidim, the Orthodox Jews tend to be inbred. So that could depress IQ levels,
right? Yeah. And, you know, the other major advantage, I guess, that Europeans have, is that Europeans are exceptionally creative, and that creativity allows them to notice things about the way the world works that other groups don't really notice. And by that, I mean like inventions, scientific discoveries, things like that. I don't think that, I think that the Japanese have this to a degree, but the Chinese less so. You look at like the very, very, the top, top end of intelligent Jews, like Albert Einstein, were heavily mixed with Southern Germans, like Bavarian blood. Also the Rothschild family. Yeah, the Rothschild family.
There is a degree to which these celebrity scientist Jews are very astroturfed.
Yeah, yeah. And I think about
Stephen Jay Gould, and you realize that this guy is actually not a scientist. This guy is just pushing Marxist bullshit, trying to insert it into evolutionary biology. And everyone else is either afraid to piss him off because he's very well connected, he can ruin them in academia, or just tries to do science when he's not looking. This whole myth of Jews are very high IQ, it's basically cover for the fact that IQ is not all that cracked up to be. It's more about who you know than what you know.
Yeah, well, it's also like about how you look at the world, right? And this is like, I'm sure you're more eloquent than I am, so I'm sure you know that there's probably a German word for this, but it's sort of your, how do you pronounce it? Weltschauung or
Weltanschauung.
Yeah, yeah. It's world the way view. the angle you're looking at a problem, right? Because if you're looking at a problem head on, it might not be totally apparent how to solve it. Whereas if you look at it from a different angle, you could see the proper way to solve it. But, you know, a good example of this is, you know, again, going back to Einstein, and you may have seen me talking about this before, because I think I might've mentioned it on my channel. But Albert Einstein, you know, for all the credit he gets, he actually stole a lot of his ideas from Goy scientists and physicists. Probably the most amazing one to me was there was an Italian geologist actually named Olinto de Preto, and he I think 10 or 15 years before Einstein published his special relativity paper, Olinto de Preto actually published a paper where he theorized and speculated that matter and energy are the same substance. And he came up with an equation to prove this. And his equation was wrong. What's amazing about it was that it was actually very close to equals MC squared. He got super close, and Einstein sort of put the finishing touches on it. The other thing was that there was a physicist named Nordstrom from, I believe, either Sweden or Norway, one of the two, that knew Einstein personally. And Nordstrom actually told Einstein when they were, you know, talking about his theories, he said, well, you know, why don't you consider that maybe space-time itself is warped? Maybe space-time is curved. And Einstein had never considered that before. And so this Nordstrom guy actually gave Einstein the idea for curved space-time, and Einstein gets all the credit for it. So this idea that, you know, Einstein, you know, certainly Einstein was a fantastic physicist and specifically when it comes to math, but his creativity was just not there. The creativity was coming from a fellow physicist that he was talking to that were not Jewish. That's sort of an aside. The other interesting thing that I found out in my research, because I was studying, you know, mutually assured destruction before I came on here, was, there was this guy named Vasily Arkhipov. I think that's how you pronounce it. Vasily. Yeah. He was on a nuclear submarine, you know, Soviet submarine that was, it was sort of circling Cuba back during the Cuban Missile Crisis on October 16th of 1962. And so he was one of the guys in command there. There was another one. And this, for whatever reason, the sub lost contact with Moscow. So Moscow was unable to reach the sub, and the sub started to get rocked by mines. And so because they couldn't have contact with the surface, and because they were under threat underwater, a lot of them were thinking that a nuclear war had already started. And so the commander of the sub wanted to go ahead and launch nukes at the U.S. And Vasily basically said to him, we can't do that because we don't have contact with Moscow. And until Moscow gives the order, we shouldn't do it. And so his refusal to agree to launch a nuke was really the only thing that prevented World War III from starting. And not many people know this. You know, they think that, well, it was all basically the entirety of the Cuban Missile Crisis was something that was going on with the president and the people involved there at the very top. But in fact, it was actually there was some decision making going on at much lower levels. And I think that's a lot of that.
This is during the Cuban Missile Crisis, or is it a separate incident?
I think it was during, because for some reason, I think the sub had been hit by mines or something. U.S. had placed a bunch of mines around Cuba as part of their response to the Cuban Missile Crisis. So in fact, it might have been afterwards, but Now here's the really crazy part, and this is something that I had no idea about until I started researching this. Currently, Russia has a policy that they call escalate to de-escalate, which sounds counterintuitive, but the policy was created by Vladimir Putin back when he was he was in the Soviet government. I'll read, there's a section of an article here on nationalinterest.org about this. Here it is. It says, escalate to de-escalate surged in popularity in the Trump years. It says, before the conclusion of NATO's Kosovo operation, Russia initiated the development of a new military doctrine that would deter any conventional or nuclear strike against Russia. It says responsible for the supervision of this effort was then Secretary of Russia's Security Council, Vladimir Putin. Coincidentally, it was Putin who would sign this doctrine upon its release in 2000, having just become president. De-escalation revises the scale of a possible nuclear strike. While Cold War deterrence was predicated on the threat of inflicting an overwhelming degree of damage on enemy military and civilian targets, de-escalation rests on the concept of tailored damage. The doctrine defines tailored damage as, quote, inflicting damage subjectively unacceptable to the opponent and exceeds in the benefits the opponent expects to gain as a result of the use of conventional military force. In other words, Russia's military planners believed that the threat of a limited or tactical nuclear strike against the enemy targets would be an effective deterrent against the conventional attack by the United States or NATO. It says, today the concept of nuclear de-escalation continues to be in play, presenting a significant challenge to Western military strategists. If Russia were to mount a successful invasion of the Baltic states, it is likely that Russia would consider these countries to be sovereign Russian territory, meaning that any conventional NATO military operation designed to restore the independence of the NATO members would likely be met with a limited nuclear strike. That is, of course, unless the U.S. or NATO cyber and other non-kinetic capabilities can disrupt Russia's nuclear command and control apparatus. So it's counterintuitive, but you know, I think that a lot of this might be the result of the advent of a new technology, which is smaller, low-yield nuclear weapons. And this is something that both the U.S. and Russia have been getting involved in, is that, you know, they've, in the past, of course, nuclear weapons were sort of would destroy entire cities. But now we have low-yield nukes, which means that you can target much more specifically. And it kind of creates this gradient where there was none before. And that gradient in technology potentially extends to a gradient in use of force. So this is it's interesting to think about. And it's not something that in a way it's kind of a white pill, because it's like, well, you know, at the very least, if we are going to get nuked, it's going to be, you know, a limited strike. And it would be something that would ideally, at least in theory, it would cause the U.S. and NATO to back down and step away. But this is all entirely speculation. And here's the other thing. This is the thing that makes it really complex and that makes it really a pickle to try to figure it out, is that we don't know if this policy by Russia is the truth or not, because there's, you know, there's no way to know if they're bluffing.
I wanted to push back against this, because I've heard of this escalate to de-escalate thing.
Yeah.
There is no Russian document. There is no Russian government document publicly available, which would indicate that Russia treats its nuclear weapons in this manner. Russian nuclear doctrine is actually pretty clear that Russia will only use nuclear weapons if it's itself threatened by weapons of mass destructions, or if the survival of the Russian state is at stake. So basically, either if nukes are flying at Moscow, or I don't know, maybe American or Finnish troops are at the gates of Moscow, Moscow will use nuclear weapons. Escalate to de-escalate is nowhere in Russian military doctrine about it. See, if it's a nuclear policy, it's a secret nuclear policy. But nuclear weapons, it's very counterproductive to have a secret nuclear policy. The point of nuclear weapons is not to use them. It's intimidation, really.
Yeah, and this is my.
I'm just gonna.
Yeah.
Just give me a second here, Carl. Mm-hmm. There is a video by this guy on YouTube. He calls himself Perun, right? I think he's Croatian. Mm-hmm. I think he's like a defense procurement guy for the Australian government, or maybe the Australian defense industry. He does these videos analyzing the conflict in Ukraine. And I'm linking this in the DLive and Odyssey chats. This is his video about Russian nuclear doctrine, where he basically attacks this concept of escalate to de-escalate, that this is actually not present in Russian state-issued documents. This is actually what the West believes about Russia. I'm not saying that this is not a valid position or a valid problem to tackle. I just want to make it clear that we have not heard anything about this from Russia itself.
From Moscow. Putin has actually come out and talked about this a little bit. I think he said, let me see if I can find the quote, because
I want to make it clear, because there's a lot of confusion in the air about Russia and Ukraine and the whole military situation here. We got to separate out what's real about Russia and what is really the product of Western attempts to demonize Russia. I understand this is wartime. Nations are going to get demonized, but this is serious stuff, the nuclear stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Well, alternatively, and this is what I was thinking, is that, you know, the escalate to de-escalate thing, It could have come either from within Russia as sort of like a psyop kind of, or it, you know, it could have come from our own guys. So, you know, there's no way to know. I mean, it's just sort of it's kind of mysterious, but Putin said, it said during a 2018 forum, he said, in our concept of nuclear weapons use, there is no preemptive strike. Our concept is a retaliatory offensive strike. For those who know, it's not necessary to say what that is. For those who don't know, I'll say it again. This means we are prepared to and will use nuclear weapons only when we are convinced that someone, a potential aggressor, is attacking Russia, our territory. So, and then he said, the very existence of the state is in jeopardy. So, yeah, it sounds to me like Putin wants to avoid the idea that he's like some sort of a mad dog, you know, and that with a hair trigger kind of. But it is worth thinking about, and I think that, you know, another one of the things that I came across was that this is not unique to Russia. In fact, I think the U.S. at one point has actually said, not as official policy, but one of their private military analysts, let's say, like in a paper that, you know, the military is constantly writing academic papers and putting them out. One of these papers has said that the U.S. should probably consider a similar policy involving low yield nuclear weapons. And in I've seen several simulations, like you can look on, you know, there's on YouTube, and there's videos where people will talk about simulations of nuclear war. And typically, like, I've actually seen one from Yale, actually. And one of these simulations shows that the person that the aggressor, the person that initiates the war, what they do is they don't even target a city to start with. They will, in theory at least, will shoot a nuke and it'll land in sort of a unpopulated area as sort of like a way for them to say, you know, we're crazy, and if you come at us, we'll shoot your cities. And so this has me thinking, well, okay, so what's a way that a nation state could do that? That a nation state could basically threaten nuclear war without quite getting to that threshold to really scare the other side. And you know, one possibility, of course, is that they nuke their own territory, even like just an unpopulated area, to show that they're willing to use nukes. But you know, of course, there's also the risk too that satellites and radar will pick up the nuke being fired and will treat it as if it were a proper nuclear attack. So it is complex, and it's not something that you want to play around with, because the numbers of dead in a nuclear war are catastrophic. Like, no matter how you cut it, like, even the most optimistic estimates place the deaths after you know, nuclear war at around like 500 million, something like that. And most of those deaths are not from nuclear explosions; they're from starvation. You know, people not having medicine, just things like that.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen threats. Most of us, I guess, it was recommended in one of the past Decamerons. It's a wonderful British films about the aftermath of a nuclear strike. There's also an animated picture about it, but the name escapes me at the time. It's also British. The British seem to really dwell on this idea that they're not going to perish in the first blast, but they're going to have a slow and painful death from radiation poisoning. Yeah. I remember, oh God, why can't I remember the name of this cartoon? It's an animated film. It's about an elderly British couple which survived the initial nuclear strikes on Britain. And, you know, so London is nuked, Birmingham, Edinburgh, all of these places, they're nuked. But because they live in rural southeastern England, I think, they don't die in the blast. They die of radiation poisoning over a period of 2 weeks. And it's actually heart-wrenching, really, just this and the faith they place in the government that, yes, any minute now, the government, the powers that be, they're going to come and they're going to save us. Where the wind blows, I think. When the wind blows, people are saying in the chat. When the wind blows, it's actually heart-wrenching. I wouldn't recommend watching it if you're going in a dark period of your life, because it's I'm rarely affected by films, but this one actually hurt me. They look a little like my grandparents. They are portrayed also.
For anybody listening, if you don't know, the way to survive nuclear fallout is to stay indoors for a few weeks. Basically, as long as you stay inside.
2 weeks to flatten the curve. I'm not falling for that one.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. as long as you stay inside for like the first couple weeks, you won't get too much radiation poisoning. There's actually one other white pill that I can offer regarding nuclear war, which is and this is, I learned this actually, believe it or not, from a comment. Somebody had made a comment on YouTube, which is, very trustworthy source, but I looked it up and he was right. He said, even a full scale nuclear war, it would not necessarily result in a nuclear winter. And there's some recent academic articles that talk about this. And, basically, the reason that a lot of people believe in the concept of a nuclear winter is because they were basically comparing it to what occurred in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and they were looking also at Tokyo and Dresden, which were, firebombing campaigns.
Yeah.
And those cities, back when they were bombed, one of the main, well, the main building material was wood. And so when you set a wooden city on fire, you naturally create enormous amount of soot and ash and black smoke.
I think that was true about Tokyo. In Dresden, it was more the chemical fires from the actual incendiary bombs used.
Yeah. Right?
Dresden was a modern city before the bombing campaign. Yeah. Well, about as modern as you can get, in the mid-20th century Germany. Tokyo was made out of wood primarily, but the firestorm in Dresden was chemical. It's not wooden.
But then the other one that they point to is, let's see. I think it was what was going on in Iraq when the oil fields were set on fire. And the theory was that if you get enough soot in the atmosphere, it would drop temperatures significantly. And so people expected this huge decrease in temperature in Central and East Asia, like 5 degrees decrease, and which in theory would lead to the starvation of millions of people, because even just a few degrees decrease in temperature means far, far lower crop yield. Well, anyway, suffice it to say, the good news is it never happened. And the other good news is that modern nuclear weapons, including Russia's, detonate about 500 meters above the ground. They don't detonate on the ground. They wait, they actually do it above the ground. And there's a reason for that. The reason they don't, they wait and detonate above the ground is because it covers a greater area of destruction. When you have the fireball low to the ground, you don't get nearly as much of destruction. But one of the positive side effects is that you also don't kick up a ton of dust and radioactive dirt into the atmosphere. And so the idea that we would have a nuclear winter is probably kind of far-fetched. I mean, I'm not saying that it's going to be a walk in the park, but at least you probably won't end up with a multiple years in freezing cold temperatures.
Yeah, it's like there is a site on the internet, which is, I think it's nukemap.com. And I play with it sometimes, So basically, if Russia detonated a Topol-type missile, you know, airburst over the government house in Skopje, mm-hmm. I would be incinerated. Right? My house is in the fireball. My office is in the fireball. Anywhere I could conceivably be on a work day, because I live downtown, I work downtown, I don't like leaving downtown when on work days, right? I would just be incinerated completely. Yeah, I'm not in the blast wave, I'm in the fireball.
Yeah. Like
maybe on weekends where I'm off visiting friends and relatives, maybe I am blasted to pieces instead of incinerated, right? But this is in the case of an airburst. In the case of a ground detonation, you know, I only get incinerated if I'm at work. So yeah, something to look forward to. We have donations, Carl. We can get into the donations. And this is actually very fascinating, but we still have to get into the whole. I will mention that we do have examples of nuclear winter, but it's never been nuclear. The only times when the Earth's climate has been significantly impacted due to soot is from volcanic eruptions.
Yes, yes. Right. And actually,
so we're talking, and they're pretty big, like not Mauna Kea in Hawaii belching out a little lava. No explosions like Krakatoa or Vesuvius in the Pompeii mm-hmm. eruption. This is not so much a question of soot in the atmosphere as dirt particles, pyroclastic flow, just everything that the Earth, and of course, these volcanoes, they explode with more force than even the Tsar Bomba, which is the biggest nuke ever made. Krakatoa laughs at our biggest nukes. So even 100 nuclear bombs, I don't see how they could kick up so much soot and dirt particles into the atmosphere
to
blot out the sun.
A single major volcanic eruption would basically be like doubling the amount of carbon dioxide and toxic chemicals that humans have put into the atmosphere over 200 years. Like, I mean, and it would occur within like a week.
Yeah.
So, and here, the other amazing thing about this,
I remember like 10, 12 years ago when that Icelandic volcano basically shut European air travel down for a couple of months, but I don't think that really impacted the climate of Europe.
No, I think the reason it shut it down was because the it was putting a bunch of particulates in the air that if the jets flew through it, it would basically destroy the engines. So they couldn't, you know, they couldn't fly planes basically for a while. You know, this is a very interesting subject because scientists can actually see when major volcanic eruptions occurred, and they're able to know this because what they do is they look at ice cores. And, you know, if you dig down deep enough into permafrost, you can see hundreds of thousands of years into the past, and you can see approximately where volcanic eruptions occurred. And they can date them pretty specifically. And I think the most recent major volcanic eruption was like 53,000 years ago, which is a very long time in terms of major volcanic activity. So we're due for another one soon. And by soon, I mean, you know, probably at some point in the next 10,000 years. But, and, you know, the same thing is true for major asteroids.
I wouldn't tempt fate, Carl. This program has already experienced a minor earthquake.
Oh, really?
Well, it was I think January when we did the show about Kazakhstan with Riley of Edwards Slavsquat blog.
Really?
It's if I were you, I would move as far away from Yellowstone as possible.
Oh yeah, that would the Yellowstone would be the granddaddy of volcanic eruptions. I think it would completely destroy the U.S. And speaking of earthquakes, actually, I experienced my first earthquake recently, like in the last couple of weeks. I was there was a small earthquake near me, and it was the strangest thing because it was like I heard it before I felt it. It sort of sounded like a truck idling outside my house. Like, you know, a school bus or a truck engine sounds when it's idling. I could hear the rumble basically of like an engine for about 5 or 6 seconds. And then right after that, all of a sudden the house started to shake. But anyway,
feeling right in 2013, we had, it wasn't serious. There were injuries, but mostly from people panicking, you know, mm-hmm. in Skopje. And, it's one of these, how do I put this? It always starts with the sound, because I think that as the earth starts shaking, it starts shaking below the surface first. And
yeah.
the sound of the earth shaking travels faster than the actual shockwave of the earthquake. And then you get the shaking. It's sometimes vertical. Those are the really scary ones, because you can lose your balance if you're standing.
Right. There's two types of waves that earthquakes produce. There's the compression waves, which make the sound, and the compression waves, they generally don't shake things that much, but the big waves or I think they're called the P waves, and they actually shake things up and down and to the side. And that's where you really get a lot of damage. And those are the ones that don't really produce noise. It's the compression waves that produce the noise. But anyway, we're due for an earthquake. We're due for another, dinosaur style asteroid event. We're due for, let's see, what else are we due for? We're due for, I think we're much safer from like a gamma ray burst, because that's always a possibility, you know, that somewhere in the Milky Way galaxy, there's some star that just happens to be facing toward us when it explodes, and then it shoots its gamma rays directly at the Earth. So who knows? Yeah. Maybe
just the solar flare that wipes out our electronics. Although I'm not
actually,
sure how,
yeah, the how solar bad flare that would be at this. Yeah, I was going to say point. that might actually be a good thing. the solar flare would. I thought about this. I think a solar flare and a nuclear war would probably put us in like back in the 1800s for probably at least a few decades. And that would be kind of interesting. It'd be really cool to see how, like, culturally what that does. Certainly, you know, we could expect things like feminism to go away.
I wouldn't bet on it. Yeah. I think that basically if our electronics were wiped out tomorrow, it's something I noticed when my power went out a couple of years ago, and I didn't have
generator.
I didn't have a smartphone at the time.
Oh, okay.
Hmm. Right? And so I had no electronics, no working electronics. And I mean, I had my very stupid phone at the time. And so what I did was I picked up a book and I read for about half an hour until the power came back. And I think the reality of it is that people are saying, oh, our brains are fried due to the smartphones. I think if you removed the stimulus of the smartphone or the internet or the television, I think we would reconfigure back. Not people are saying in a week. No, I think you would reconfigure within the day.
Yeah.
I think that... I mean, and maybe I'm optimistic, but I think that these things are not as addictive as we make them up to be. It's their availability that makes them so dangerous. And it's like someone who has struggled with addiction in the past, you know, the key thing about getting over the addiction is to reduce the opportunity to turn yourself to sin. When I quit smoking, I threw my cigarettes away. I threw my lighter away as well.
Yeah.
Because a lot of smokers keep their lighters out of habit.
Yeah.
Don't do it. Don't keep smoking.
You basically inserted an extra step between you and restarting the smoking again, which is you would have to go out and buy another lighter. I think you might be right. It might be pretty quick that we would go back to normal.
People were speculating that why people are so why is it so hard for guys to quit porn, which is also an addiction, is like it's like basically you're an alcoholic, but you don't have the opportunity to throw the booze out of the house.
Yeah. Right? Well, so
the
imagine,
booze is always in your pocket,
Right. Yeah, right. Imagine if the only way you could access porn was if you had a special device specifically for it. In that case, it'd be easy to quit because you could just throw the device out. But anyway, yeah, I mean, you know, and I noticed too, when I travel, you know, I'm traveling to different countries or whatever. I'm on a limited time. I don't get to spend a lot of time in the country. So obviously I'm not going to be on the computer or the phone while I'm there, because it's essentially just a waste of my money if I go to another place and spend it on my phone. So, but it's just amazing, like how, I guess it's almost like you're kind of more, your locus of awareness or your locus of control, like moves more outside of your body when that happens, because it's like, you're no longer focused on, okay, what can I look at to satisfy my brain, versus, you know, when you don't have a phone, you're like, okay, what can I do in the physical world to satisfy my brain? And when, you know, when you're in that mode, you're, it really does sort of, it's a physical sensation. You can feel a realignment in your brain. It's kind of wacky.
I was recently in a foreign country, and we have roaming, right? My phone, I didn't have phone internet, and a friend suggested I actually get a prepaid SIM card so I could have internet. And mm-hmm. one of the reasons I didn't get it, because I enjoyed not having that opportunity, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when I'm back home, I reach for my phone every other second, almost. Like, I think I may be developing actually a pretty dangerous phone addiction. Fortunately, I mean, I still don't do it while I'm driving, but I think I might get there sometime. And this is where the danger actually is, I think, with these.
Well, you know, you could think too, is like, imagine how many millions or possibly even, well, billions of human relationships that would have been started if it had not been for phones. Because if you didn't have a phone, you would be forced to talk to other people, ask people their opinions, and ask people for directions and things like that. And so because we have access to the phone, we no longer need to strike up conversations with people and strangers. And so, you know, you tend to lose that dimension I can imagine, you know, after like a nuclear war, you would see a flourishing of human relationships that just would never have occurred otherwise.
You're such a positive person, Carl. You try to see the good in everything. Well, of course you're dying of radiation poisoning, you're bleeding out the ass, and you're going to shit your intestines out. But look at all the possibilities for human relationships. I mean,
yeah.
You remind me of Full Moon. He's one of these ultra positive people, and because like I'm a stereotypical melancholy European.
It's an American thing. It's something, you know, they put lithium in the water here is what it is.
Yeah. I don't know. It's like, it's one of those things, I guess. We got some super chats we got to address. We have $20 from Scott. Thank you, sir. He's actually sent this before the show started. So I actually have a prepared answer for a change. Do you think modern infrastructure and human specialization has made war costlier to wage? Before the 20th century, the carnage of war was mostly confined to battlefields and open waters. Today, conventional weapons can blow up a city and destroy resources like highly skilled people that cannot be easily replaced. Would you like to answer that, Carl? Do you have any thoughts about that?
Ooh, yeah. That's a great point. You know, I think it just, I think in another 100 years or so, when people are like looking back on 20th century and 21st century, early 21st century, they'll kind of recognize it as the period in time when we foolishly over-centralized production and, specialization. And so, you know, it's sort of like, you think about, what happened recently with Russia and the US shutting down, trade and also financial transactions with Russia. It revealed that the world is far more vulnerable to supply shocks and supply chain shocks than a lot of people had anticipated. And so, yeah, it could you could consider that to be a higher cost. And, you know, who knows, maybe ideally in the future, we would increase, you know, decentralization. We're starting to see, I think China actually talked about the Chinese recently commanded their highest ranking officials in the Communist Party to sell off all their investments over the overseas investments and to only invest in local Chinese businesses. And, you know, that's just because they witnessed what had happened with the Russian oligarchs and they wanted to kind of preempt that so that they would not become vulnerable to similar financial sanctions or trade sanctions. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's that I think decentralization of production is going to be, or it should be, a national security concern. The problem is that just the nature of humans is that they will not do things that are unnecessarily difficult or inefficient. And one of the, it's inefficient to decentralize production. It's efficient to centralize it. And so I don't know if I could be optimistic about decentralization of production, at least not yet. It's one of those things that it might not happen in our lifetimes. It, you know, might be, who knows, another 100 or 200 years before we have, you know, everybody always talks about like 3D printers and, you know, robotic farms and things like that. And I just don't see that being a thing until it's necessary. You know, necessary is the mother of invention. And I just don't see the necessity just yet. So yeah, Scott's probably right that war today is, in a sense, it's kind of easier to wage without going full scale, because all you really have to do is just shut down supply routes.
Because the supply routes today are far more fragile and far more, the impact of shutting down a supply line. It's what you said about decentralization reminded me of in Nassim Taleb's Skin in the Game from 2018. He points out that basically part of the reason why Russians were able to maybe not thrive but survive in the 90s, where basically the Russian economy fell apart at the seams and people were reduced to sustenance levels, it was the paranoid commie idea that every city or at least every oblast of the Soviet Union should be, in as much as possible, autarkic.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
So at least, even if nothing else could be done, at the time, almost every oblast of the Soviet Union could provide its own food.
It's, right? You know, people lived
crappy lives, but they survived.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny that the Russians were able to pull that off, because the Chinese were not. In fact, if you study Chinese history, like Mao,
the Chinese are very different from the Russians.
Yes. Yeah. Well, one of the things that Mao tried to do when he took power was he wanted to create what he called a honeycomb economy, which is where, you know, you would have different hexagons or different regions within China would become independent economically, in a sense, right? They would each produce their own stuff. And while this was a great idea in theory, like communism, in practice, it was a complete failure, because they attempted it and it caused extreme poverty and it was just stupid. But honeycomb economy.
I would say this is due to the fundamental difference of the Russian and Chinese national characters.
Mm-hmm.
Because like I mentioned before, despite all of the claims otherwise, the Russians are whites, right? They're white people.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the capacity for decentralized operations. We've had on this show Dr. Ricardo Duchesne and Happer Perspective. Right? Mm-hmm. One of the very first episodes of the Writer's Block was about the fundamental differences of racial character between whites and Chinese. And I'm, you know, the Russians, they managed to pull decentralization off in the Soviet Union. We've had decentralized governance in Europe for centuries, right? We had feudalism, which is very decentralized. We have the piece of Westphalia system, which is, again, a type of decentralized common European way of doing
things. Well, look at the government of Switzerland. I mean, that's like insane decentralization. And you know, that's the thing that libertarians always point to. They say, oh, well, why can't we be like Switzerland? It's like, well, you know, you can't do it if you don't have the proper genes for it. But
you need local elites. You know, somebody has to be in charge. And unless you're centralized, the benefit of centralization is you can have a smaller elite. A smaller group of people actually creates state policy. If you have a decentralized state, you have to have a much larger elite. You have to have a lot more people who are actually part of the decision-making process. Maybe they're just making decisions for their own little village, but this guy is still a decision maker. He still has to have some high status, a lot of say in society. And you need basically the aristocratic egalitarianism, which Ricardo Duchesne talks about as characteristic, you know, of Indo-European people in general, but specifically of Northwestern Europeans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is present in all white peoples, but it's really, really present in Northwestern Europeans.
Right.
Right. This is actually very interesting about the supply chains and how fragile they are. I mean, I was surprised to learn that Russia ran out of potatoes due to sanctions. I mean, Russia. It's Russia. Like, we stereotype them as eating potatoes every day, but apparently there's a shortage of potatoes and potato seeds, which is even scarier.
Yeah.
In Russia.
What's frightening is how unintelligent American and Western leaders are generally when it comes to planning ahead, because it's like, you know, they become obsessed with things like getting vaccines out, which have, you know, 12% efficacy rate, but they don't think at all about the fact that China produces the vast majority of our medical equipment and our antibiotics, right? So in a scenario where China just decides to stop shipping these things to us, we're fucked. I mean, we don't have the manufacturing capacity yet to do it ourselves. So it's just amazing, you know, these are national security questions and nobody's talking about them, because everybody wants to think about, oh, you know, abortion and, you know, crap like that. But anyway, and then, you know, one of the other things that I was going to mention, and I don't know if you want to get into this, but I thought it was pretty interesting, was you may have heard of the Fermi paradox,
Are you getting back to the main discussion, because I have my own answer to Scott?
Oh yeah, yeah. Go ahead. You can answer it.
Right. So Scott, you mentioned that. Let me just read the question again. Infrastructure and specialization has made war costlier to wage, and before the 20th century, the carnage of war was mostly confined to battlefields and open waters. This is actually not true. Now, the medieval warfare saw a lot of spoilage. I forget the technical term. It's French. A lot of rapine, essentially. You hit at the enemy's ability to produce and recruit. So basically, you burn down the villages because you cannot take the fortresses. This happened a lot in medieval warfare. It was common in Napoleonic War. There was a lot of destruction of cities, which is, you know, why some cities deemed especially beautiful were surrendered without a fight. Famously, the Russian Navy retreated from Dubrovnik, you know, because they didn't want to fight Napoleon over it, because they realized it would destroy the city. And it is one of the most beautiful cities in the world to this very day. But I will say, I will post a link in the chat to the site called Anti-Empire. It's actually, I think, the most, it has the most balanced coverage of the Ukraine-Russia conflict. I'm putting it in the DLive and Odyssey chats. And it's specifically about the ability of cities to function as fortresses in modern warfare. So I think that should address the question of when you say conventional weapons can blow up a city and destroy resources easily, actually there's a lot of ruin in a city, as we are seeing with the examples of Mariupol and Kharkov and all of these places in Ukraine. It took Russia 3 months of very heavy fighting, very high casualties. They spent almost all of their smart munitions bombing Mariupol, and all they have really have to show for it is a pile of rubble after 3 months. So it's I wouldn't say that modern weapons are so advanced. Outside of nuclear weapons, cities can take a lot of punishment.
This is where sort of science fiction potentially, I mean, like, you know, there's potentially in the future going to be neutron bombs, which would allow you to take a city without actually damaging the infrastructure, because, you know, it would just kill the civilians and, you know, all the military, and leave the infrastructure intact. But that's, you know, I don't know. I haven't really researched how likely it is that neutron bombs are going to become a thing anytime soon. But anyway, we were going to talk about the Fermi paradox. Well,
It is basically, this is probably the most controversial opinion I hold, but I think that the Geneva Convention prohibition on chemical weapons is basically a measure to prevent smaller nations from having a WMD deterrent. Because what describe what can be done with a neutron bomb, you can also do with a bottle of sarin nerve gas.
Right.
And this is going to sound probably pretty sociopathic, right? But if there was no Geneva Conventions, then countries like, say, Finland or Sweden, they wouldn't have to break bread with countries like America in order to have a WMD, a deterrent against nuclear-armed states. Because a nuke is actually very difficult to construct. It requires a massive industrial base. You know, Iran's been struggling to do it for 30 years. And if a country like that cannot do it, what hope does a smaller country like Finland or Macedonia have, really? But I happen to know for a fact, don't ask me how, that Macedonian chemical industry is advanced enough that we can manufacture enough sarin to destroy America and Russia together, right? So if a country of 2 million, you know, in the middle of the Balkan Peninsula can do it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, after the Germans invented sarin, of course, we can copy the recipe. It's actually easy. But I think that this prohibition on chemical weapons is a sort of an imperialist measure to prevent small nations from securing their sovereignty, because we depend on the big nations for nuclear protection, essentially.
Right.
It's probably nuts, right? I'm probably saying this because I'm a crazy person, but it is the way it is, right?
Well, you know, anytime you're talking about balance of power and international, you know, threats of war and stuff, you basically are required to think and talk like a sociopath. I mean, there's really no alternative.
There is no human way of addressing these subjects.
Right. Right. Exactly. I was going to say, you know, one of these things that you always hear about is that eventually humanity will destroy itself somehow. And the theory is that we kind of know this is going to happen because of the Fermi paradox, which is that basically you have 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. And, you know, around these stars are, you know, many of the stars have planets that could potentially sustain life. And by now, after, you know, billions of years, you would expect that there would at least be a few of them that would have intelligent life that was sort of spreading, you know, throughout the galaxy. And the question is, well, why haven't we detected it? Why can't we see any indication of it? And the theory is that you would have that the reason we haven't detected it is because anytime a species becomes intelligent enough to become starfaring or, you know, planetfaring, you know, multi-planet species, it destroys itself through some kind of, you know, nuclear war or something like that. And I don't personally buy into this because, like I said, I think, you know, even in a worst case scenario with an outright total nuclear war, I think you would still have at least 500 million humans remaining alive that could survive it. And, you know, because life is extremely resilient. And, you know, you have a lot of people who are going to figure out ways to make it through something difficult like that. And I think that, but see, what's interesting to think about though, is the type of culture that would form after a major nuclear war, because World War One was such a devastating and horrible conflict, but toward the end of World War One, everybody was like, well, this has been so horrific that, we will never again have a major war like this, because industrial warfare has become the norm, and it's basically so catastrophic that there's no way anybody will declare war again. Well, I mean, you know, it was just a few decades later when you had World War II. So, you know, just because you have a terrible war, in this case, a nuclear war, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to never have another one again. I mean, you know, it could keep, you know, who knows, we could end up in like a cycle of nuclear wars every, you know, 50 or so years. I mean, that would be awful, but it's a possibility.
Yeah, the First World War engendered a lot of revanchism among the European states, as it's called, basically Germany feeling humiliated, needing to prove, you know, that it could defeat France again, Hungary resenting all of its neighbors due to the Treaty of Trianon, basically the Soviet Union and Poland going at it in the east. I can just think of, you know, yeah, let's have another war because you nuked two of our cities, but we only nuked one of yours.
Exactly.
Nuclear revanchism, right? Yeah. 5 million of our people died, but only 3 million of yours. Yeah.
Absolutely.
You could actually get into this kind of one-upmanship between countries.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is the nature of, like, it's the nature of humanity and storytelling, right? Like, this is, you know, this is why politics is ultimately storytelling, because, you know, and you know, Jews understand this very well, which is why they constantly harp about the 6 million. If you can tell a story about how your people suffered more, then you can create justification for aggression in the future. And so, yeah, this is also why I do not for a second buy into the idea that the white race is doomed, you know, that we're just going to be replaced. You know, like, no, it's not nearly that simple. What's going to happen is that, you know, even in a worst case scenario where Europe is flooded with Africans and Arabs, you will have a group of whites that will develop that type of revanchism, where they just say, you know, they'll develop an identity, they will develop a sense of entitlement to the land, because they will know, you know, it's impossible to make people forget their history. They will know the history of Europe, and they'll want Europe back.
It's impossible because people like us maintain this history.
Right, exactly. Right? Exactly.
I wouldn't be surprised if actually white identitarian politics becomes easier when there's fewer white people.
Absolutely. Oh yeah. No. There's no because, question. Yeah. There's no question. I mean, you know, it's sort of like, I don't want to trivialize it, but it's kind of like fashion. You know, fashion comes and goes, and, you know, eventually it will come back into fashion. You can't stop it. But yeah, it's, and, you know, I think what's really, you know, talking about war and things like that, I think that the risk of war over the next 200 years is actually going to decline, not necessarily because of technology, but because of the fact that, we're probably going to have a much smaller total human population. I think that over the next couple hundred years, we will lose billions and billions of people just because of reduced fertility. And to me, that's a great thing because it means that there's more land, there's more resources per capita, you know, So I'm somewhat more optimistic in that sense, but I think that the Fermi paradox, it's probably overblown because I think that this, you know, if you study astronomy and if you understand the distance and the spaces we're talking about here, even a massive multi-planetary species that's been beaming, you know, powerful radio signals out in all directions for hundreds of thousands of years, even in that crazy scenario, the odds of us finding it are just astronomically low. So it's just, and then also, I think that biological entities like ourselves, things that are cellular organisms, they reach a balance with their planet. They reach a sort of a balance. And this is where I part ways big time with Elon Musk, right? So Elon Musk is always talking about, oh, well, we have to go to Mars. We have to become a multi-planetary species. To me, that's idiotic. I find the idea of terraforming another planet, changing another planet to be amenable to human survival is so foolish. I can't even imagine a very advanced civilization being able to do that, let alone wanting to do it, because your quality of life is always going to be so much better on Earth.
Mars in particular, right? I remember having this debate like 1,000 years ago, almost, in 2014, I believe, with an astrophysicist, actually, that I say, okay, you're going to flood Mars with water. You're going to carry ice asteroids. You're going to slam comets into it until it has enough water. Okay, let's say you hypothetically can do that. Mars has two massive problems if we're going to populate it with human beings. It has half of Earth's gravity, which means that if you try to live on Mars, you will become osteoporotic in a very short time.
Right.
You know, like how astronauts lose bone density, and basically if they spend too much time in space, their bones become so fragile that they cannot lift things, that the bone just snaps off. This is actually very dangerous. Now, Mars is not zero gravity, it's half of Earth's gravity. So you're not going to become osteoporotic at the same rate as astronauts do, but you're eventually going to become so fragile. You could very easily become very fragile before you turn 35, say, right? This is one problem that there is no way to solve this problem on Mars.
Artificial gravity is
wanker. The second problem is Mars has no magnetic field.
Yes.
Mars has no magnetic field, which means that basically you're exposed to solar and cosmic radiation. It's going to cook you alive.
Yeah.
Even if you terraform Mars and turn it basically into Earth, you're still going to have to live in a habitation dome, which is fortified against cosmic and solar radiation.
Yeah. It'll fry your balls, so your sperm won't work, so you won't be able to reproduce. So
it will fry your everything, right? Like we were talking about when the wind blows, you die shitting your intestines out.
Yeah.
That's life on Mars. People have suggested that, oh, we can solve the gravity problem by not colonizing Mars, but colonizing Venus, which has 0.9 of Earth's gravity. So it's actually our twin planet, really.
Yeah.
But there's another problem. Venus has no magnetic field. Even if we somehow tackled the problem of the atmosphere and the heat and everything wrong with Venus, right, it still has no magnetic field. Yeah. Earth is actually unique among the rocky planets. It has a magnetic field which shields us from cosmic and solar radiation. The magnetic fields of the other rocky planets is almost negligible.
Yeah,
we are fully exposed to this shit.
Yeah, and you know, this is something that I really, you know, I observe Elon Musk on Twitter almost every day. I see what he's doing, and this is something that I really hope that he internalizes and comprehends at some point in the next few years, is that he needs to be focused on improving Earth rather than thinking about running away to Mars. This is my approach, is that I would much prefer scientists and businessmen and people like that to focus on turning Earth into a paradise than thinking about creating moon base and things like that on other planets. It's hubris on a scale that's, unfathomable to me. But then again,
the thing
I guess
is right. I'm not a technical person. I'm not an astrophysicist. I'm just my degree is in civil law, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a bit of a space nerd, so I know these things, but I'm sure all of this has occurred to Elon, right? To yeah. Elon Musk. I don't think he has solutions to these things. Maybe he can solve the radiation thing, but we're going to live in the habitat domes. Well, you can't solve the gravity problem. It's unsolvable. Yeah. So, and I'm sure he knows this. And this leads me to conclude that this whole Mars shot thing is basically a form of grift.
I think you're right. Yeah.
Maybe he's deceiving people for the greater good, but if he's not, he's trying to grift off of the hope of colonizing Mars, which I understand. We're an explorer species. We're an expansive species. I actually do think we should, in as much as possible, become a multiplanetary species. I just don't think it's possible with our present level of technology. And I think that unless we can somehow find a way to invent artificial gravity, which is not possible, with our knowledge of physics, the only place we'll be able to go is Venus, right?
Yeah.
Which is still better than nothing.
Yeah. Well, and Elon, one of the things he talks about is he says, recently anyway, he says that he uses the term the woke mind virus. And he says the woke mind virus is going to prevent us from going to Mars. And it's kind of almost like a, I'm trying to think of the term. There's a term that it might be a vulgar term even that the right uses on occasion, where they're basically talking about Africans, potentially holding back humanity and preventing us from progress. But it's essentially that. I mean, and coming from a South African white man, you have to kind of wonder if he is either subconsciously or maybe consciously and just using different words to say the same thing, we have to have, and this is really the root of the problem, really, is that we have to basically make it so that separation is acceptable again, politically acceptable, because currently it's not remotely politically acceptable for different groups to segregate themselves and have territory. And that's a kind of view that's will be laughed at in the future, because it should be laughed at now, but it's just amazing to me how widespread this has become, that every human being on Earth, every hominid on Earth, I should say, is somehow innately entitled to step foot on every square inch of surface of the Earth. it's just bonkers.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I was thinking about this because, like I said, I'm an insane person. I have severe psychological problems. I was thinking about this. I should make a map of the city of Skopje, but it's personalized to me. It's going to be in proportion to the amount of time I spend in this place, right? And I have just basically this idea of, so my house would be huge,
yeah,
right? Take up, because I spend most of your time in your home, right?
Mm-hmm.
The places I go regularly, they would be a little bigger. The roads I take more frequently, they would be bigger. And everything else in the city, right? The majority of the surface of any city, even if you live in it, you've never been in there because you've never been to most people's houses. Mm-hmm. You've been to your house, been to the houses of friends and relatives. You've been to areas open to the public. Not all of them. You've been to some of them, right?
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. To claim the right to step all over the planet, right? You're thinking in these planetary terms, like I've never been to most countries in the world. I've only, it's like, and I don't want to. I don't want to live there. Maybe I want to visit, you know, as a tourist, as a guest, but to claim a right, it's, we'd have to abolish private property.
Well, and it's also like this weird, it's this strange, like, psychological condition, because it's like, you know, I've thought about this. Like, I want to go to Japan one day just to visit as a tourist. But, you know, I thought, well, if I go to Japan, what if I encounter some Japanese people who are racist against whites and they just decide they hate me? Well, it's like, I mean, unless they like physically assault me, I would actually be pretty amused by it. And I'd probably actually be kind of happy because I would say, you know, it's a good thing that the Japanese don't want me there. You know, I would respect that and I would get out.
I've been to countries where people are not very nice to foreigners and, you realize that, yeah, it's not a pleasant experience that when people are not being nice to you, and especially service personnel, which is quite a culture shock. I don't know how it is in America, but in Macedonia, service personnel being rude is kind of blasphemous, right?
Oh, really?
It has like a religious dimension, being polite to guests. So it was really shocking to me to see service personnel, so waiters, clerks, being rude to me, you know, because I'm a foreigner. But you realize that, yeah, this is not my place. I'm a guest here. I should know my place as a guest. Maybe I shouldn't be a little arrogant. Of course, I don't think that it excuses the rudeness, but you start really thinking about this. I was thinking about this when I was being checked, like a long time ago. I was suspected of trying to smuggle drugs into Croatia, like 7 or 8 years ago. And I'm thinking, why is this border guard so paranoid? And I'm thinking, I would be paranoid in his position as well. This is the right attitude to have.
It's
inconveniencing me personally, but this is the way to go, you know?
For sure. Yeah. It's, it just shows you that the huge chasm between the mentality of most Europeans and whites versus like Africans and Jews, you know, which is, you know, typically, you know, it's like, well, I can go anywhere I want to. And if you don't like it, then, you know, screw you. And, versus Europeans, which, you know, it's like, oh, you know, do I take my shoes off before I enter your home? it's a totally different mentality. I don't know how much of that is genetic. I would assume some of it has to be, there's gotta be some degree of genetics involved, but hopefully the bulk of it is cultural, because I hope that one day whites are more, a little bit more protective of their spaces, which, you know, I would assume they would be, because, you know, just as recently as a few hundred years ago, whites were extremely ethnocentric, not even within their race, but like within their tiny little hamlet, you know, they were pretty xenophobic outside of that.
Yeah, I mean, like, I live in the Balkans, right? Former Yugoslavia basically tore itself apart over differences between Serbs and Croats and Macedonians and Slovenians and Bosniaks. And if you look at a genetic map of the Balkans, we are closer to each other than, you know, the Northern French are to the Southern French. So, but these things became very serious during the Balkan Wars. So, yeah, we still have the potential to become very strongly ethnocentric in both the positive sense of loving our own and in the negative sense of distrusting outsiders.
Yeah.
I just think that the cultural poison preys specifically on the European, but also the most strongly on the Northwestern European default psychological disposition, which is weakly ethnocentric. So we're very open to outsiders, and we are individualistic, which I have to read Kevin MacDonald's Individualism and the Western Liberal Tradition to make more sense on this subject. But I think this is the army we have. This is the people we are. And no amount of whining about how Jews are more ethnocentric than us is going to change this. We either develop a political formula which works for white people, or we die out as a race. It's that's our burden as content creators. I will say one thing about the Fermi paradox, since you mentioned it. The Fermi paradox arise out of, I believe that there was like an exchange between Enrico Fermi and an American astrophysicist. I forget his name. And it was typical optimistic American versus pessimistic European. Fermi is Italian, of course. The American said, well, there are hundreds of billions upon billions, you know, the whole Carl Sagan thing, billions upon billions of planets with stars, with planets, with galaxies. So there's got to be aliens, right? There's got to be alien life forms. So Fermi just posed the question, yeah, but where are they? Why haven't they contacted us yet? So yeah, it's true that there's billions upon billions, and the probability is almost one that there are other life forms, but where are they? We cannot see them. And there are many answers to the paradox. The most negative one is the one you mentioned. They have destroyed themselves with nukes or other nasty technologies before they had the chance to reach us. Personally, I like the rare earth explanation, which is that the conditions necessary for life to arise are actually very rare in the universe. I mentioned the Earth's magnetic field. There is some speculation about how it came to be and why the other terrestrial planets, and especially Venus, does not have it. If you think about it, no complex molecules can really arise without a shield from cosmic radiation. And I don't think you can have life without complex molecules. So I think Earth is actually pretty rare as a phenomenon, as a place where life can thrive. So that's the Fermi paradox. It's something to chew on. You know, where, if there are so many aliens, why haven't they contacted us?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know that I would. I mean, I'm sure life is rare, but I don't know that it's that rare. I think that maybe the bulk of the problem is timing, because you know we've only been able to beam and receive radio signals for like a little over 100 years now. So there could be thousands or even hundreds of thousands of other civilizations out there, but the problem is, over the course of millions and millions of years, are two of them going to kind of line up perfectly in their development that they both use radio signals at the same time? And, you know, it's possible also, this is fun to think about. It's possible also that maybe there's a better way to communicate than radio signals. And maybe we just haven't found it yet. And, you know, this is something that I've considered, which is that, you know, could be that you could use neutrinos to communicate. You know, neutrinos are subatomic particles that pass through everything practically, you know, effortlessly. They don't ever collide with things. It's extremely rare that they do. And in theory, again, this is totally sci-fi. We don't know how to do this, but theoretically, you could create an internet where instead of using electromagnetism to send signals, you could beam neutrinos directly from the source to the destination through the planet. So instead of going around the surface of the Earth, you could just aim it directly down through the Earth to whoever you want to hit, and they would receive the stream of neutrinos. And so you would have sort of a, it would be an internet that would be impervious to interception or surveillance, right? Because you would directly communicate rather than go through middlemen. Mm-hmm. But if that's possible, then, you know, yeah, you could completely dispense with electromagnetic communications and radio waves.
And of course, neutrinos do travel faster than light. So
they travel, I don't know if they travel faster than light, but they travel.
Maybe they travel, yeah, at the speed of light.
Yeah. And so
I forget. I'm sorry. It's been ages.
I think the only thing that I know of that anybody ever said travels faster than light is, I'm trying to remember. It's a subatomic particle. That's like the antimatter version of an electron. It's like a positron supposedly travels faster than light.
In any case, if the neutrinos are limited by the speed of light, then they travel at the same speed as radio waves, which also travel at the speed of light, which again does not help with solving the Fermi paradox. Maybe helps us, communicate with you through. We actually bypass the Atlantic Ocean. I just beam my hot takes to China and to America. I'm not sure how much that would be good, but in any case, right? It's not a solution to the Fermi paradox, and we would, I guess, detect beams of neutrinos just streaming in from halfway across the universe.
It would be tricky because the difference, see, is that with radio waves, they go out in all directions equally, mm-hmm. whereas with neutrinos, it would be like a laser pointer, basically, right? They would not spread out, and so a neutrino based communication network would it would be very unlikely that we could intercept that, because the beam would have to be aiming directly at us. So it would make, and so this is the other thing is that, you know, a lot of there nerds, especially like Elon Musk and people who love Star Trek and stuff like that, they make the assumption that alien species or any species, any technologically advanced species is going to want to consume an enormous amount of electricity and energy and is going to want to utilize the entire energy of the star. And the theory is that the theory is that, you know, if you become technologically advanced enough, we would see you because we would see, you know, indication that you're utilizing the energy of a star. But who knows? That might not be the case. I don't think that's the case.
What they call it, the Kardashev scale Kardashev scale, right? Yeah. Of energy consumption.
I don't buy that. I think what's more likely to happen is that, assuming humans don't destroy themselves somehow, I think what's more likely to happen is that we will end up reaching some sort of a population stasis, like a kind of a balance, right? Where we are at perfect harmony with the Earth, and that we basically create a system where we can have heaven on Earth, which is, you know, who knows, it might be aided with like drugs or virtual reality or something like that. But I think that there's going to be a point where we just simply stop trying to spread out and grow, because we will have reached a perfect balance with nature. So I don't buy the Kardashev scale. I don't believe in that. I think what's more likely.
It's interesting to me, the only way to fully harness the energy of a star is to build a Dyson sphere around
it. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Which means you blot it out of the sky.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that actually would make it less, the civilization less visible.
Now, what could do that, and what might be more likely to do that than a biological entity would be artificial intelligence or robotics, right? So potentially you could have, if humans somehow create AI that is capable enough to reproduce itself, then it could theoretically last forever. You know, it could just spread little bots throughout the universe, and that they could go and multiply and, you know, latch on to like asteroids or, you know, whatever, and produce more of themselves. I think that's more likely. I think biological things like us are just, we can't really survive interstellar space like robots or, something like that could. And you know, that was sort of the theme of 2001, A Space Odyssey, which is, you know, the I forgot what they call it, the big block that they find on the moon. That's supposed to be like an AI robot that was sort of, it was created by an advanced species somewhere. You don't know who they are, but they sent these things out, and that, you know, millions of years later, they come to our solar system. And actually, I consider that to be the most likely. If we're ever going to encounter evidence of another life, intelligent life, I think that's the most likely way we would encounter it, is through finding one of their robots or something like that. The tachyon, I think that's what they call it. It's the thing on the, you know, the monolith.
I don't know. It sounded like you're describing Space Odyssey for 2001.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah, 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yeah, it's I'm sorry. I didn't like that film all that much. I don't know.
Oh, really?
It was too visual, right?
Yes.
I'm a very visual person, so I guess I like to be entertained in a non-visual way. I don't know. It's something about it was just, maybe that's the point. Maybe it's supposed to be unsettling.
It was a little pretentious, I think, but you know, I kind of liked it because it was, it left more questions unanswered, you know, and that's sort of the thing about like modern science fiction movies tends to, they answer every mystery, you know, and they don't leave any mystery left to the audience to consider. And so to me, that's sort of one of the fatal flaws of science fiction, is that it or at least modern science fiction, is this a little bit too explanatory.
Yeah. It's it is rather, maybe it's a question of just mere aesthetic. I do like other Kubrick films. It's that one in particular I don't find appealing. We have question. Well, it's a comment really, and a combined comment and question from ABC for $5 American. He says, nuclear fission Han and fusion Bethe, the first chain reaction from Fermi, rocket technology from von Braun. All of these discoveries were made by Europeans and then stolen by non-whites and Euroasiatics and turned against them. And these are all the technologies necessary for a nuclear triad, for delivering a nuclear bomb.
Yeah.
He asks, are we suckers? What do you think, Carl?
I think that yes is the short answer. I think that, okay. If it had been up to me, you know, or if I were back, you know, back in World War II, post-World War II, I would have, if I had been the U.S., I would have done everything possible using the CIA to kill off any foreign scientists that were going to try to copycat us, you know, creating their own nukes. I think that would have been the route I would take. But then again, you know, I guess the appetite for war after that was so, you know, people were basically thrilled that the war was over. And I think it was sort of like drunk punch, being punched drunk or whatever. And I think that made people not think very clearly. And, you know, that's part of the reason that the UN was created. I think that the UN is idiotic. I would not have created a UN. I wouldn't have allowed it. But anyway, you know, that's just the way
it's the way an America which looked out for the interests of Americans would have behaved, is what you're describing.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this. I was talking with a friend about General George S. Patton, because, you know, we were comparing him to Francis Parker Yockey, essentially, they had very similar views, but mirrored one against the other. The way he said, basically, he realized later on that America in the war had fought the wrong enemy, that he said we should ally with the Germans and destroy the Soviets. But then he died, possibly assassinated, and Patton was the last sane man in the American federal government, I think. I will point out, however, that it was the atom bomb was not independently discovered by Soviet scientists, but it was given to the Soviet Union by the Jewish spies, Ethel and
Rosenberg.
What's his name? Yeah, the Rosenbergs. The woman's name was Ethel. I forget the man's name. Right. Because, you know, Jewish men, they're completely dominated by their wives. It's it's pathetic, really. I would feel sorry for them if they weren't.
You know, it's funny. It's like there are lots of famous, female spies. It's kind of crazy how it's almost like, espionage is definitely like a female endeavor.
Yeah, basically, people think that espionage is like James Bond, but one of my favorite films is Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which is like a painfully realistic description of what espionage is really like. And you realize this is a bunch of intellectuals having essentially academic conflicts with each other, but it's life and death.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
To think about the conflict in that film between Smiley and Carla, which is their name for Moscow Center, right? This could easily be two professors in a department competing for grants.
Yeah.
Right. Actual espionage is very low testosterone, very low. And of course, the most famous real world spy on the planet is Mata Hari. That was a woman and a whore. But yeah, maybe that's a story for another day.
Yeah.
For my part, I want to answer you, ABC. I want to answer your question. Yes, we are suckers, but our enemies are also masters of subterfuge. So basically, this is if you look at history, right? Why are the Jews such a problem? It's not on their own merits. It's because they successfully instrumentalize other larger and more powerful, more competent empires, right? Jews will insinuate themselves into as the middleman minority, as advisors to the elite of great empires, the Ottoman Empire, of the Russian Empire, of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, the British Empire, the American world order today, although they retain reserve presences in Russia and China just in case. This is what they're specialized for. And of course, Europeans, and especially Northwestern Europeans, were uniquely vulnerable to these kinds of attacks, right? So that's the short answer. The long answer, I suspect, is found in the works of Dr. Kevin MacDonald. Not the ones about the Jews, we all know about the culture of critique, the one about us, individualism and the Western liberal tradition. As soon as my dopamine receptors are restored from the telephone addiction, I will probably get around to reading that. So, yeah. Carl, we are almost at the end of our second hour. Since we were all over the place, would you very briefly summarize your position on why you don't think mutually assured destruction is the be-all and end-all of humanity?
Well, I look at it like two guys with guns, right? But the problem is that it's not a perfect analogy, because if you have two guys with guns in a room together, and they the one that shoots first wins. But when you're talking about nuclear intercontinental missiles, it doesn't matter who shoots first, because you can see it coming and you can retaliate immediately. So I think that it's more akin to two guys without guns who are capable of beating each other into a bloody pulp. In that case, do they instantly beat each other into a bloody pulp? No, they don't. They might punch each other, you know, on occasion, but they will tend to try to avoid conflict as best they can. And I think that I think that there is a middle ground where you can use nukes, but that they will be utilized in such a way as sort of like a warning shot almost, and that the warning shot is enough. I think that there's a new gray area that's been opened up between full scale war, nuclear annihilation, and just simple, you know, sort of straightforward non-nuclear war. And that we need to, I believe we need to talk about this more and publicize it more and hope for it more, because the more people, the more intellectuals and thinkers and academics think in these terms that, that you can, you know, have a gray area between that, the less likely it is we will have all out full scale nuclear war in the future. And so that's, it's sort of like a meme thing. We should hope that we can kill the meme of mutually assured destruction.
That's interesting to think about, because this is basically the reason why the Soviets and the Democrats try to present Ronald Reagan as a complete nutcase, mm-hmm. right? Because of the Strategic Defense Initiative.
Yeah.
Because of this project, which, I mean, Reagan, he was a classic alpha male. He hated this idea of mutually assured destruction. He wanted something to be like, how about we win and they lose? You know, classic victory. Yeah. And he believed in the possibility of this. Ronald Reagan actually believed in this. And at the very least, the Pentagon tried to deliver. People mocked it. But it is something to think about. It is, you know, and of course, we being white identitarians, being the distant right, I'll never get tired of saying this. We are an elite class in the making. We should start thinking like people who will eventually rule the world. It's also a way of positive visualization. Our friend James O'Meara has written a lot about
It worked for the people who are currently in charge of the world. I mean, you know, like the people who are currently in charge, they did not start out in charge, and you know, they ascended to power very quickly, you know, so.
It's definitely possible. People they don't like to believe it, but it is definitely. I think it's maybe fear of success, because when I don't feel particularly smart, let me tell you that, Carl. And I just had an image of myself basically running a portion of the world, and it's scary. I think I would be a little bit in over my head.
Well, I mean, you compare yourself to. The people who are, you know, currently in charge, I guess, like, you know, Joe Biden and some of these other guys. I mean, yeah, you know, you're easily on that level and above. So it's like, I think the smartest people are the ones often that are stricken with, you know, self-doubt. So,
yeah, the worst, what was it? The best lack all conviction, whereas the worst are full of passionate intensity. Yeah, I'm mangling that quote, obviously. But it is entirely in the, I mean, if Elon Musk has not thought about the radiation and gravity problems with colonizing Mars, if he's actually sincere about it and it's not a grift, right? I don't think it speaks well that the richest man in the world, who's also a bit of a, I think he's a scientist, right? He's not just some businessman, has not thought of this possibility and how to solve it. I think that would actually be the worst scenario than him just grifting off people who hope to go to Mars, or any other approach that, I mean, I'm not exactly a big fan of Elon. I don't trust any men who use hair plugs. So, my grandfather was bald, right? He walked around bald his entire life. He went bald in his early 20s and, I respected his courage. What can I say? Well, in any case, you got anything to add, Carl? Because I think it's time to.
I think we can finish up.
Well, folks, this has been the Writer's Block with Carl Thorben. We discussed many things. We were supposed to discuss mutually assured destruction. I'm sure we got around to it. Carl is usually our cryptocurrency expert. But I'm glad to say that he's such a colossal nerd that we can carry on a conversation about space, disaster events, and nukes for 2 hours without Crypto ever entering the conversation. So am I. This was a very cozy nerd stream. I loved it. I enjoyed it. And I want to thank Carl for being with us tonight. I want to thank everyone who tuned in. I want to thank everyone who donated on DLive, on Odyssey, on Entropy. Everyone who donated through Cash App and MoonPay too. I'm not able to see those donations, but I thank you anyways. And I want to thank our heroic and dauntless moderators. I want to thank Reed Johnson, Bartleby, and Gadius Maximus, who have absolutely been dominating the chat. No bad actors whatsoever. I did not see a single peep from the agents of the enemy or from the forces of autism of Spurgery in the chat. Thank you, kind sirs. And with that, bye-bye, folks. Bye-bye.
Bye, Nick.